Hello, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about Episode 6 of Undisclosed Seasons 3, Look into the Conviction of Dennis Perry, Looking at Me Like I'm Looking at You, which examined the witnesses to the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain back in 1985 and revealed how having more witnesses didn't necessarily yield more clarity. With us today is Rabia Chowdhury. She is the best-selling author of Adnan's Story, and she's host of the 45th podcast. Welcome back to the show, Rabia.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm good as well. We also have Susan Simpson. She's an associate of the Volkov Law Group and also the host of the 45th podcast. How you doing, Susan?
Hey, I'm good.
All right. She's calling in from parts unknown today, so it's very exciting.
Yes, from a parking lot in a car. So if you hear a background noise, my apologies.
Just tell everybody you're investigating something. You're like knee-deep in an investigation, and
yes,
you have to be in a parking lot.
It's in the middle of big developments or something like that.
Okay. Also returning to the show today is Stephen Janis. He appeared in our Freddie Gray investigation. He is an investigative reporter who works for the Real News Network in Baltimore. He is the author of Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore, and also the host of the podcast The Land of the Unsolved. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's good to be back.
So just to start off a little bit, what does your podcast look into?
Well, you know, as a reporter, We try to not just look at unsolved cases, but sometimes the politics of unsolved cases. Like specifically, we've been looking into the mysterious death of Detective Sean Souter, who was a Baltimore homicide detective who was found shot in an alley in Baltimore. And, you know, initially police said it was a lone gunman, African-American, locked down the neighborhood. And then slowly that case began to fall apart. And now no one knows what's going on. And, you know, there's just a lot of politics behind the scenes in these cases. And we try to talk about that because we're exposed to them as reporters, but it's not always easy to write about them or to report on them immediately. You need kind of a little time to delve into it. And I've seen a lot of cases that seem to be more about politics. And when I say politics, I mean police culture and, you know, government sort of intervening in these cases and dictating where they go and how they get solved. So we kind of try to focus on that.
Well, yeah, and this particular time for the Baltimore police is incredibly crucial. I mean, they've been in this amount of tumult for several years now, and they're really in the public eye. I mean, it has to be very, very dramatic what's going on over there.
Yeah, as your excellent podcast pointed out in the Freddie Gray case, couldn't have been more received more national attention. And now our police department is under a federal consent decree after the Justice Department found out, investigated and found that they use racist and unconstitutional tactics. So technically right now they're under, you know, a judge's supervision. In some cases, it's not receivership, but it's a consent decree. And so it makes it all the more fraught that they had a hero's funeral for Detective Souter. But it turns out that he was involved with the Notorious Gun Trace Task Force, which is another scandal we're dealing with in Baltimore, which was eight officers who were convicted or pled guilty to dealing drugs, robbing residents. They're basically, I don't know if you want to call them a rogue unit, but certainly an example of how out of control Baltimore policing is in our city. So it's pretty crazy, you know.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I had read at some point that the Trump administration, once they came into power, that they had said that they were going to like walk back the consent decree, or they were going to order the DOJ to like not pursue it or enforce it or something. And I mean, it sounds like that didn't happen.
Well, right. I can answer that. I mean, very quickly, what happened was they kind of signaled that, and the mayor, just before, you know, Trump took office, they quickly signed the agreement. And so now it's in the hands of Judge Eric Bedard, who really is the person who focused on, but the Justice Department has not been taking a real active role. It's really been the judge who's been, because the consent decree was already signed before the Trump administration took control of the Justice Department. It sort of has a life of its own.
The other question I was going to ask is, as you know, I have a special interest in Baltimore. I think we all do. But how long have you been kind of following like institutional problems with BPD and, you know, the corruption and stuff? I mean, are we talking about decades? This is like a really old issue, like Philly, or is this like how long has this been going on?
So I started really reporting on the Baltimore Police Department in like 2005 or six. And, you know, I wrote a book with a Baltimore homicide detective going back in the 1970s. And, you know, we talk a lot about corruption back then. But I think during the aughts, when Martin O'Malley instituted zero tolerance policing, where they were arresting 100,000 people, is when that department just went into like a totally different phase of insanity, because they basically, you know, said, forget the Constitution, forget following procedures, just go out and arrest as many people as you can. And as the Justice Department report pointed out, that meant focusing on African-American neighborhoods, predominantly poor African-American neighborhoods. So I think that that culture that infected the police department made the corruption just extremely prevalent. And, you know, there have been a series of scandals since then. I mean, certainly this is not like a squeaky clean department. You can go back years and find all sorts of cases. But I think elements like the Gun Trace Task Force were sort of created in that era of zero tolerance policing, when they sort of just said, you know, you go into a neighborhood and you disrupt and you do whatever you got to do, and don't worry about the Fourth Amendment, don't worry about anything else. And, you know, I've been writing stories for years about crazy arrests and, officers taking money and all sorts of stuff. It only became, you know, sort of crystallized in the national focus with Freddie Gray, as your podcast pointed out. Until then, people basically, you know, there were some notice, but they brushed it aside, especially the political leadership. But then once Freddie Gray happened, the political leadership couldn't ignore it anymore. And you know, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings like asked the Justice Department to come in. But people have been calling for the Justice Department since the inception of zero tolerance, which was really, for people who weren't there, it's just hard to imagine. They would just literally grab people off the streets. It was like we were living in the Soviet Union. When you're arresting 100,000 people a year in a city that only
has...
Yeah. It was like it really was. We had what was known as the jump out boys. We'd jump and they would load people in the van and take them to central booking. It was like nothing. I don't know. Like, I think a lot of people wouldn't really understand, you know, what it was like. So about since then,
it's gotten a little better since then. I have to imagine that even if you were a police officer in those conditions who meant to do your job well, any organization that takes on a huge uptick like 100,000 prisoners can't function. I mean, I don't understand how a bureaucracy would even function under those conditions.
What was interesting about it was that they had you raise a good point. The central booking facility that is where most of these arrests were processed was only created to process 40,000 people a year. So they would make all sorts of weird things. Like, they had a thing called a walkthrough, which was, and these are things that were invented by Baltimore, where a person just bring the person down to central booking, they would walk through the process and immediately be let out. And then you had something called a beta by arrest, which was a totally, like, as far as I know, I couldn't find any other jurisdiction when I called around, they weren't familiar. A beta by arrest meant, like, if someone was like peeing on a sidewalk or drinking with an open container, once you arrested them, the situation was abated. So they didn't keep you in jail. They just let you go. And then there were people that just got lost in central booking. And, you know, there was a lawsuit because people would languish in there for days. And a lot of people that I would interview would say they'd never got charged, and they would sit in there for 4, 5, or 6, or 7 days. And they would just be fearful. It was like Kafkaesque, that no one would know they were in there. So it really did break down in some sense. It is extraordinary that the police department was able to process that many people. It's really hard to imagine. But the system, you know, we had like a 50% released without charges, and it wasn't that many. We made 25-30%, and then another 25-30% dismissed. So you had this huge amount of people going through the system who were never charged with a crime, or the prosecutor would null process them almost immediately. So it was like a big human, you know, it was hard. It's hard to just people coming in and coming out. It was like a factory or something.
Well, yeah. And actually in the Soviet Union, it was never like that. Actually, it was a model of bureaucratic functioning compared to that, now that you mention it.
I mean, one of the stories that I did that really got a lot of traction was when they arrested 7-year-old Gerard Mungo. He was like, he had just turned 7. He was sitting on a little electric dirt bike, and a cop, we later learned through investigation, took it from him. And his mother called and complained, and they decided to arrest him in retaliation for the mother complaining. So they ended up arresting this kid who handcuffs couldn't even fit on his wrists out of retaliation. And, you know, the story I wrote got picked up by like 110 newspapers, because people around the world couldn't believe a city was arresting a 7-year-old. But the thing that was really interesting was the police department pushed back and said, you know, he committed a crime. And it was crazy.
How could we not arrest that 7-year-old?
Yes, exactly.
After a while, it was like a big net. It was like trawling. They had to get everyone they could to keep the numbers. And Martin O'Malley, who goes around touting his liberal credentials, was fixated on numbers and thought that numbers would eventually produce safety, which I think if anyone believes that, come to Baltimore and you will see that more law enforcement does not necessarily produce safety. I'm sure you guys all know that, but some people think it does, and it certainly didn't work in Baltimore.
Well, I can tell you, as a New Yorker who lived through the 90s in New York, which was sort of the debut in a major metropolis of broken windows policing, it was Giuliani. And I have to say, the advent of stats-based policing did have a cultural effect on the city at the time. And that's why people came away thinking, oh, that works.
It's always touted as the example of it working.
But we know now that demographically, crime plunged at that period of time everywhere, even where they didn't use broken windows policing. So, the cultural perception of the fact that that stuff works really came from New York in the 90s.
And I always tell people, consider the metaphor of a building, when you're talking about human beings. It's very interesting. We're going to fix a community by fixing the windows that are broken, but you're talking about people. And that's where it gets really kind of weird when you think about this whole idea that if we fix the broken windows, well, how do you, you want to fix people, but you're going to fix people by incarcerating them or by using the threat of taking away their freedom? I don't know. Didn't work here. That much I know.
Yeah. In New York, I have to say that it got that perception because day-to-day living was just more pleasant. It just was, and that goes a long way with people who actually vote.
Whether you have a personal passion and pursuit or a business goal, well, everything starts with a website. That's where people go to figure out who you are, what you're about, what you want to say to the world. And that's where so many of my initiatives started, whether it's this podcast, Undisclosed, my other one, The 45th, my book, A Non-Story, has its own website. And then there's my blog, where it kind of all started, Split the Moon. I needed a website to start all of these initiatives and turn my dream into reality. And a website is a pretty exciting thing to create because you can build something from scratch that exists in reality, that reflects who you are, what you're about, that talks about your brand, that tells the world your story. But it can seem daunting, especially if you're not tech savvy. But believe me, I can barely email, but I can still make a website because I use Squarespace. Here's what Squarespace does. They first of all have beautiful templates that are designed by world-class designers. So, you just go in. All you got to do is figure out what template looks good to me. Do I like this style? Do I like that color? Do I like this layout? Click on the template. So easy. Fill in your content. It's step by step. They have now a brand new way to buy domains. So you can pick the name of the website that you want and choose from over 200 different extensions. So for example, if you don't get .com, you can find the same name with another extension. It gives you so many more options to get the name that you want so your brand stays on point. They have fantastic analytics, and analytics are very important to help you grow in real time. We always, when I say we, me, Susan, and Colin, always check our analytics for Undisclosed to make sure that listeners are still listening, to see what they're interested in, to see when things dip, and to figure out, hey, where can we grow our audience? Nothing to patch or upgrade ever. That's it. You make it, you're done. And they've got 24/7 award-winning support. It's pretty amazing. So check out squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. What you can do is go to squarespace.com/undisclosed, create your site, have some fun, make it gorgeous, make it exactly how you want it. And then when you're ready to launch, just use our offer code undisclosed and you will get 10% off that website, or you can pick a domain name and get 10% off that. If you can think it, dream it, you can make it with Squarespace.
I think there's an interesting overlap between this case, Dennis Perry case, and your Unsolved podcast, because the Dennis Perry case was unsolved for 13 years. And obviously some political machinations, we've gotten into them a little bit on Undisclosed, took place to cause the case to be reopened and Dale Bundy to be brought in. And I wanted actually, Susan, to ask you, do you know much about what Dale Bundy actually did once he was brought in as an investigator?
Well, you've heard about pretty much everything he's done as an investigator that we know of. I mean, this case definitely was political. We've gotten a bit into that, like you said, and there's definitely more to come. But I think to some extent, a lot of cold cases are political in nature. And the ones that are sort of high profile like this, I mean, the politics is everything. But Bundy's investigation was, by his telling, and again, Bundy, I've never heard or seen another case where this happened, but his record keeping was basically non-existent. We have that 6-page report, the Bundy Report, it's on our website if you want to check it out, that he wrote in November of 1998 that summarized his work from end of June till then on the case. And that's it. There's no notes he took at the time, no reports he made at the time, no live records of interviews he was doing. There's nothing. It's just that 6-page report. So that's all we have to go on. And who knows how complete it actually is. But from that report, we do at least have the official story of what all he did in the case. And there's not much to it. He spends a week, he gets the case, he starts, he spends a week looking at the files, he goes through the files, he decides that I should go talk to witnesses. He talks to two of the church ladies, the first two. Those first two ladies are the only two who are ever shown a photo of Dennis Perry, the only two who are really used to identify Dennis. At least, I actually don't believe this is true, but at least according to the reports we have, those are the only two church ladies that Bundy ever talked to. And in fact, his entire case against Dennis came from his first four interviews. It was Cora Fisher, Vanzella Williams, Jane Beaver, and Jane Beaver's daughter, Carol Ann. And that was it. That's the case.
Well, yes, because there wasn't any new forensic information at that point to be gleaned, was there?
Well, according to Bundy, when he came on, all the forensic stuff was already lost. Now, this case was in 85, and by 98, we started to have DNA technology. So theoretically, there could have been some great DNA evidence that a cold case investigator would want to go into. Like, hey, look, we have technology now. Let's find out what was on those Pepsi bottles we found at the crime scene. But that stuff was all gone. So they did not do the testing.
So
apparently,
yeah.
You know, I had some pretty good sources in homicide. And they would give me case files. And, you know, even cases that don't go that far have huge amounts of paperwork that the homicide detectives at Baltimore City, which are not the most proficient in the world, you know, update Lotus notes like every day when they're working on a case and every time they talk to someone. So that seems really unusual to only have 6 pieces of paper.
They have routines. Yeah, he had no routine like that. He did nothing. He took 0 notes. According to him, according to the reports we have.
Unusual. That's unusual. All detectives take notes.
Even in shady cases, that's unusual. But he literally never wrote down a word for the first, like, 4 or 5 months of investigation. Not a single word.
That is completely unprecedented. I mean, just every case. I mean, that's one of the things they pride themselves on is filling a file so that when you finally get a file, it's, like, so thick. There might not be great stuff in it, but they want to just show their supervisors that they did work. And so almost every file I've ever pulled has been huge. With these updates, you know, your writer went here, your writer talked to this person. Because it could become important during the case. You know, the chain of evidence or whatever. That's just really unusual. I've never heard of that.
I'm amazed that a district attorney, a prosecutor wouldn't be like, what is this? What are you giving me? I mean, where's the files? Where's the notes? How do you build a case on nothing?
Well, don't forget, this is the detective who got a confession, apparently, and didn't write that down. Even though he saw that there was no paperwork recording it, he never bothered to mention it to anyone until trial.
Wow. Yeah, that's really weird.
Can I ask, there were obviously other investigators. There was investigators from the GBI. Was that their practice as well? Were they not so great at the note keeping?
I would say that they were not. I wouldn't give them an A+ or gold star for their note keeping. But they were like the Baltimore police. They had the procedures. They had a contact. They had a communication. They recorded it. Now, of course, the GBI in this case had a process. They shredded their notes after the fact to make sure there was only a single report of the interviews that they wrote after and typed up, which is problematic. So we don't have the original notes from any of these interviews. We just have a typed up statement that GBI agent, mostly Rhodes, but others involved later on, prepared. So, you know, not great. Allows for a lot of stuff to be missed or to change in subtle ways where the report's correct, but, you know, the bad facts for them aren't included. But yeah, they have notes. They have all that stuff done. It was only the Camden County Sheriff's Department, well, only really Dale Bundy, that had this procedure of never taking notes, except for the barest minimum possible, done months later after the fact.
He also had a kind of unorthodox style in that he would show up out of uniform and talk with these people and basically wait for many months to actually write down what was said. But he seemed to have a good memory. He seemed to certainly vividly describe it to you, Susan. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. No, really, honestly, he had a good memory, which I think may have gotten him in trouble because his memory was so good that he would often forget things that ended up as part of the official record and would default to his actual memories. That was my impression from talking to him. But overall, I actually think he had a really good memory. He did forget a lot of stuff. There are a lot of things he got wrong that were just genuinely, it's an old case. And of course, he didn't know every detail, which I'm not going to fault him for that at all, because that's, I think on average, he has a better memory than most.
And I have to say, you know, I would somewhat give him the benefit of the doubt in terms of Cora Fisher, because he saw that she had this tremendous reaction to seeing a photo of Dennis. And I have to say, if I was an investigator and I saw somebody literally faint dead away or come close to it because they saw a picture of a guy, I would believe that as well. Later on, however, if I'd been given the information that whenever she's shown the picture of a white guy, she faints dead away, I think that might have changed my perception. Did he ever find that out? I mean, that was in the deposition.
He was there. He was there in the room when she said that. I think he believed her. Like, he did seem to be, when I was trying to, you know, press him on stuff, like, hey, like, okay, here's why, I mean, I was explaining why I was there and why I had questions about the case and was trying to, giving him a chance to tell me every reason why Dennis was guilty. And it was very helpful. But also, when I pushed back against certain stuff, he'd be like, well, you didn't see what Cora did, or you didn't see how Cora reacted. So for him, that was a very, like, powerful piece of evidence that just kind of solidified in his mind that, oh my God, it was Dennis Perry. But Cora Fisher is, I mean, I don't, not to speak ill of the dead, but I think she was a little bit of drama. I don't think that's unfair to say.
Well, who knows what her particular experience of life was, and that there may have been perfectly good reasons that, you know, any contact she had with white people was very negative, and, you know, she had a bad reaction to it. I understand
and
that.
And she was absolutely terrified, for sure. Like, that was genuine. The ladies were, many of them were scared. Of course they were. Mm-hmm. And her fright was real.
But she says things in that deposition that are astonishingly, I mean, they just out and out say, this deposition is worthless. You know, anybody who says, you know, basically all white people look the same to me, or at least white males, that she says something to that effect and then says, by the way, I faint at the sight. You know, I pretty much think any picture of a white male that is shown to me is that killer. Did the defense attorney, you know, grab hold of that and play it up, at least in their closing statements?
Well, no, not really. So here's part of the deal. We don't actually have all transcripts for this case because the court decided that Dennis Perry was not entitled to them. So we're still working on that part. We have most of the witness testimony. We do not have closing arguments. But we know from opening arguments that was not part of this case.
I have a question. Did they gave her a photo array? Because I was listening to that.
No photo array. One photo.
Oh, wow. Well, you can't do that.
Exactly. It's so flawed, dude. Stevens hasn't been able to listen to all the episodes. Dude, you gotta, because it's jaw-dropping.
It's a one-photo lineup. So basically what happened is there was a lady in the community who was the mother of Dennis Perry, the defendant's ex-girlfriend. And at some point in the early 90s, she gets it in her head that Dennis Perry, this guy that used to date her daughter, ended on good terms. There's no kind of, like, grudge being held there as far as I've seen from anything. But she decides it was Dennis Perry that was the killer. So she takes a photo of Dennis Perry from her daughter and goes to two of the ladies from the church, Cora Fisher and Benzola Williams, and shows them the photo of Dennis Perry and says, this is the killer, right? And one says, oh, yes, that's him, and then fainted. And the other one said, I can't be sure, but it looks like him. And by pure chance, massive coincidence, the first two witnesses that Bundy goes to talk to in 98, years later when the case reopened, are the exact same two witnesses that Jane Beaver, the woman from the community, had gone to.
Wow. You know, it's interesting. When I was listening to the podcast, I was thinking about, we had just had a case of a man named Jerome Johnson here who was released after 30 years in prison. And then a case about 6 months earlier of another man who had been falsely incarcerated. And both of them, you know, was all witness testimony, eyewitness testimony that later fell apart. And these cases continue to happen in Baltimore. And usually it's not forensics or, you know, it's always eyewitnesses who later recant or, you know, some circumstance, or they say, you know, they were influenced by this or that. And it's just very fraught, you know, especially so when so much time has passed, it's a lot of these cases hinge upon that kind of stuff, end up, you know, having being problematic down the road. And so it kind of reminded me of that, because the testimony is weird, and not having an actual photo array is hard for me to understand. Was the jury made aware of that she just looked at one picture?
Yes, but the logic was because Jane Beaver, a private person, had already shown her a photo, a single photo. Well, that bell's been rung. There's no point in showing her a photo array now. But interestingly, they never, ever asked They never asked for a live identification. They could have had Vanzola Williams, who also was shown a single photo. They could have had her try to identify Dennis Perry at trial. And by that point, she'd even seen him at hearings. So she would, you know, you'd think she'd have a pretty good chance of doing it. But apparently, the prosecution decided it was not worth risking it and didn't ask her to try and identify him.
I mean, that would definitely be something that would, you know, a defense attorney would bring up, I would think, because that's just a very flawed identification process.
They tried, but not really as well as they might. I would say, looking back in hindsight, 2020 and all that, they did not necessarily make the jury as aware as they could have made them aware that this is an extremely influential way of doing a lineup. And that, I mean, first of all, 15 years on, having a lineup to identify someone that you saw briefly under stressful circumstances is going to be hard. That's going to be a hard identification to make for anyone. Add in this, like, one single photo lineup, and then you are... It's not even a single photo lineup. Add in the single photo.
Yeah, right. It's not.
Is it him?
Well, and it's interesting because you guys brought up, did such a good job of bringing up all the inconsistencies with all the people. Makes it even more fraught, you know, just, sorry to use that word again, but just makes it even more tricky because the people all, from what I listened to, the people all sort of had conflicting descriptions. They couldn't even agree upon his hair color that evening.
Yeah.
So to rely on one single photo, that's just very sketchy. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Of course, there's the alternative explanation, which the police did consider, is it possible there were two people there that night?
Mm.
Maybe. I mean, it could be, but also at the same time, eyewitnesses are terrible in general. So it doesn't really surprise me that they disagreed like that.
You know, anytime you have multiple viewpoints, you're going to have conflicting accounts, I would imagine, you know, and so I think police are reticent to feel like everything is completely useless because they have to work with something. They have to put some store in something. Stephen, if you get a chance, check out the website and check the composite drawings because they are very, very telling because there's four of them. They were done by four different witnesses. And if you look at them in order, it's one is Kurt Cobain. The next is Kurt Cobain with glasses. The next one is also Kurt Cobain with a little bit of funky eyebrows. And then the third one, the fourth one is Slim Jim Phantom, the bassist from the Stray Cats. It's like...
I don't know who that is. I'll have to look it up.
It is a completely different human being. I mean, yeah, one of the investigators joked that it was Alfred E. Newman, and he actually does have a little bit of, he's got a little Newman-esque look there. Not to compare Slim Jim Phantom to Alfred E. Newman. That's not cool. But my point being that it was no exaggeration, Susan, when you said one of these things just does not look like the other, and that Dale Bundy went with that one is so strange because he's the one who, that composite looks the least like Dennis Perry.
Yeah, well, none of the composites, those four composites, look like Dennis Perry at all, hardly. So it really didn't matter which to choose. None of those four are a good match for the guy. And we'll get more of the composites later, but it's worth noting that the fifth one, the final one, it was, you know, used input from all four women to make it. And also, if you'll notice in Cora Fisher's deposition testimony, when she's talking about whether the person in the photo is the person that she saw in the night, she actually isn't saying that the picture in the photo is the picture she saw in the church. She's saying the picture in the photo of Dennis Perry looks like the picture of the composite. So her comparison is not even to her own individual composite. She's just comparing Dennis Perry's photo to the joint composite and saying, yeah, they look a lot alike. They favor one another.
It just seems so weird that in a small community, someone could do a murder like this and there would be no information in the community about a possible suspect. I mean, even in Baltimore, you know, word gets around when someone gets killed. And it just seems weird that, you know, just listening to the first episode and how you guys describe the area, like that there would be no information in the community and that this would be such a mystery. It's just weird.
Yeah, he was a white guy in a black community. There's a lot of reasons that people would be aware of this person.
But Bundy's theory is they all knew who it was and they were too scared to come forward. Bundy believes that the women all knew who the killer was, and then for 13 years till he came along, they just were too terrified to tell anyone.
I mean, that's totally possible. I mean, that's totally possible, you know, because there is a dynamic, you know, having covered things in the South, and, you know, when we went down to it, we did a lot of work in a town called Pocomoke on Maryland's Lower Eastern Shore, and there's a dynamic between law enforcement and the African-American community of distrust, and it's pretty deeply rooted in history. So it's not completely improbable, but You know, it's still just very, I don't know, that just strikes me as weird.
What, was Cora the only one who spoke of being intimidated? I mean, she said that Dennis supposedly was watching her from his car. Was that the Plymouth Duster, by the way, that was mentioned?
Apparently, perhaps. It's not clear. I mean, Dennis never had a car until, like, he was, like, mid-20s. So he didn't have a car at this time. And there are attempts to try and get him a car, but in the end they get him on a motorcycle, because that's what he drove down, supposedly, Camden County on. None of the other women reported events like that, like being watched by the guy in a car. Some of the women were scared. Some were more scared than others. All of them were, like, a bit wary about stuff. Like, even today, they're, like, you know, kind of wary-ish about it. But no one else described that.
Just the reason I ask is, like, did Vanzolo Williams describe that? Because she obviously, she went on Unsolved Mysteries. She put herself out there as a witness to this. If you were afraid of retribution, would you go on a TV show?
Well, actually, she didn't. She recorded an interview. She did not want her face on the show. So, yeah, she was scared, too.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there you go.
But at the same time, they also did a number of interviews with law enforcement over the years. And there's not really, I mean, you read the transcripts, and to my eye, there's no indication I've seen that they know something and are holding back, because they seem to be cooperating quite a bit. Like Gwen Owens, supposedly she's the one who was totally non-cooperative. She's so frightened that she told the cops, or her daughter told the cops, that the man had red hair and, like, flames shooting out of his mustache, because she didn't want to give a real answer because she was too frightened. But there's nothing in her report that's just that. She is very well composed. Like, she gives very, like, detailed answers. She's probably the most coherent of the witnesses in terms of telling a very, like, logical, all of them just witnessed a horrific murder, and they're going to be flipped out. Like, I would probably just, like, mutter incoherently if that was me. But she's able to give a very coherent, descriptive answer about what happened, what she saw, what she experienced. So it's strange to think that that's actually her trying to hide the fact she knew who the killer was.
I thought it was interesting, because didn't you tell the sheriff that, you know, who was originally investigating it, that she had said this, she knew, and she hadn't said to him? Wasn't there a part in the podcast, and he had that really interesting reaction to it, like he couldn't talk for a while? Or did I miss it?
He didn't know that. That, to him, that was a shock.
That was a really powerful moment, I think, about the whole case, because he was like, he couldn't talk for like 20 seconds or something, you know?
That was GBI agent Joe Gregory, and he had, it never, I mean, I guess on one hand, you could see him, and he was defensive, possibly, because to think that all along the killer was known and he wasn't good enough to get the answer. So that's probably how some people would see it, as like him being just upset that there was an answer there all along and you just couldn't get someone to tell you a name. On the other hand, it's just him being like, what the hell? Like, what? That's not what the case, that's not how it went down. I worked this case for 5 years and I talked to those women, and, you know, I can't tell them, I can't say they didn't say what they apparently said, but that's not something I've ever considered being possible.
Yeah, interesting.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, I am so excited to announce that Undisclosed has finally launched a Patreon page. Now, if you've ever wondered how you can support our work, this is finally one way you can do so. Of course, by listening to us, you support us, and we are so grateful for that. When you subscribe and give us 5-star ratings, I'm so grateful for that. But to be honest, production costs money. When you drop 2 episodes a week, it takes resources. It doesn't just take our time. It costs money. We have folks to pay in order to produce these podcasts, and we have defendants and their families counting on us to continue doing this work. So you can become a patron of Undisclosed for as little as $5 a month. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod and sign up there. Now, along with feeling great about yourself because you are supporting the work of fighting for the wrongfully convicted, guess what? You also get a bonus episode. Every single month, Susan, Colin, and I will drop a bonus episode that's only for patrons, in which we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to be discussing other cases from other true crime series that we find fascinating. Now, our very first case, our very first episode in the Patreon feed, is all about the case at the heart of the latest season of In the Dark. We're talking about the Curtis Flowers case, and we are talking about it the way we talk about all cases on Undisclosed, like three lawyers looking at the facts. So if you love the In the Dark season 2 series and you're fascinated with the Curtis Flowers case, which is ongoing, and you want to know what Susan, Colin, and I think about it, well, become a patron and check it out. And if there are other cases that you have heard about on different true crime series that you would really love to hear Susan, Colin, and I unpack, then definitely let us know. Tweet at us, post on our Facebook, send us an email, and we will definitely take a look. So once again, thank you for supporting Undisclosed for the last few years. Check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod.
Did any of the other witnesses testify to hearing a sixth gunshot, the one that Cora was certain happened?
No, but the women heard different numbers of gunshots. Like Gwen Owens, for instance, heard two gunshots. And they ask her about it, and she's like, well, I can't go by hearsay. You're asking what I heard? I heard two. Which to me makes her a more credible witness, because she's clearly acknowledging she knows that other ladies are saying there's more, but she's not changing her answer to the right answer. She's just saying, I heard two.
And I heard that they knew what type of ammunition it was. Did they ever figure out what type of gun it was?
Yes. And we'll have more on that probably next episode. But it was a 25. It was a small gun. It would have been like a little, like really tiny, like pocket gun, which is interesting because Cora Fisher recalls seeing a big old long gun waving around when this would have been like a little tiny, like hides in your hand.
Also, she was in a different area of the church. I mean, you know, you're looking into a, I imagine the vestibule of the church was probably more brightly lit than the actual church because they're generally not very bright.
Well, if she was where she says she was, she couldn't even see into the vestibule. There's no line of sight if she was where she says she was.
Have you been to the church?
I've been to the church. I've been to the outside. I've talked to people there. I have not been inside the church.
Now, is it typical? I mean, so much of the evidence in this is just sort of inferential. I mean, they don't have him actually confessing, but what he said was kind of creepy. You know, we don't even have the notes from the interrogations that Dale Bundy did. You know, so much of this is just sort of one-off, you know, people saying, you know, a kind of weird thing happened. Is that, it feels atypical for cases.
Well, I mean, not having notes from the confession is bizarre, and that makes utterly no sense. And, you know, you sort of compound that with, and I'm just talking from experience of covering cases. And look, Baltimore City is not like the paragon of investigative prowess, but, you know, not having any notes, not having progress reports, and, you know, then having this bizarre, you know, where someone showed a photo, I'm surprised that held up in court, because that's so sketchy. All those things compounded together, just, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. I would imagine in Baltimore, and I can only speak from my experience here, that a prosecutor presented with that kind of material for a case would be reluctant to take it, because mm-hmm. the jury wouldn't convict on that. But then again, you know, you have this sense probably, you know, just how, and I'm only going from what I've heard, you know, that this couple was a beloved couple and it was a murder that lingered, that there would be some sort of communal sense to just solve it regardless. And this guy got caught up in it. But that.
Well, not really, because they actually moved the trial to the county over. So there was not a personal connection, really. And many of them, like the ones that saw Unsolved Mysteries knew of the case, but no one really on the jury knew of it from personal experience.
Wow, interesting. Well, just anyway, like I said before, based on, you know, some of the things that I've learned from listening to the podcast and what you're saying, I doubt they would have brought this case here in Baltimore, unless, of course, there was a huge political impetus to do it, you know, which can happen, you know, where the mayor or someone is saying, hey, we got to solve this case. We have something, and this may be common in other cities, called a red ball, where homicide detectives, you know, they call it a red ball because it means there's a lot of political pressure to solve it, which in our city usually involves a white person in a wealthy community like Roland Park. And if they get killed, then, you know, you got to solve this case. Don't worry about the other ones. So that would be a point where they might move forward with something that's a little flimsy. But in general, you know, this case seemed to me like something that a prosecutor would be pretty reluctant to try to bring. But it could have been the exposure from the television show, maybe. I don't know.
Well, in a place like Camden County that's that small, has so few murders, it's the red ball of all red balls. It's, you know, the only unsolved crime for decades going back. And in this case, the defense did try to exclude, like, the confession. They tried to, you know, get prove that was not voluntary and get that excluded. They tried to exclude the identification based on the unconstitutionally suggested lineup. And the judge turned down all those motions. So they made an attempt. The prosecution won. They got to use it.
And when was he disputing that the details of the confession during the case?
Well, yes, but he didn't testify. So there's no one else to to bring it up. Now, so there were three different officers at the interrogation, and one of them from the state level agency did take notes. He shredded the notes and then wrote up a report that all three of the officers read before they testified 3 years later.
Why would he shred them?
Because he wanted to make sure his report on the interview and his notes of the interview were one and the same.
I see.
Yeah. He wanted to make sure that there was no differences between his notes and the final report, which he admitted to. He was like straightforward, but he's like, well, I want to make sure there was no contradiction there, so.
And again, in and of itself raises questions.
Yes.
I mean, because the notes would be more important than the secondary report, but.
I mean, you would think you'd keep notes to corroborate the final report, but this is basically just getting rid of evidence to make sure that whatever contradicted is gone.
Well, the problem is the way they wrote that report, the way that agent wrote the report was extremely misleading. I don't think it was a lie. I do not think they were actually making this up. But there's when it comes to like a confession, when you just change a couple words, it changes the entire meaning. So the way his report reads, you start off, you're like, oh, it sounds like he's starting to confess, until you realize that what's being said in real life, what these words are actually recording here, is just entirely different from how it's played. Like, for instance, at trial, they describe how they ask him, like, where were you on this date 15 years ago? And he's like, I can't remember. I was out, like, drinking and smoking weed a lot in that time. And they write in the report, they make it sound like he says he can't remember killing the people because he was drunk and high. Or he was, on drugs and high. Which is an entirely different meaning. But, like, technically, the words in the report aren't wrong. They just suggest an entirely different interpretation than what actually went on, according to their testimony.
That's significant and interesting.
Okay, this was a weird detail. But did you ever ask Dale Bundy about where he got that detail that Harold was a guy that habitually picked up trash?
He just heard it around town. He just heard it.
Oh, okay.
I can't say that's not a thing. That, like, I mean, it's possible that's a thing that happened. Like, he could have been told that. No one I've spoken to has heard of that or recalled that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really, really interesting part of the podcast was the way to try to explain away, you know, the glasses, which seems like such a significant piece of evidence because they're so specific. You know, and I mean, it was interesting too, because as you reported, and I think that the person without them would be legally blind. I mean, wow. But, you know, it seems to me that it was self-serving. And this is just my opinion of trying to say that the glasses were not relevant and that he picked them up seems so entirely random, you know, mm-hmm. that I just don't see how you could exclude that from the case. I mean, it seemed to me that that was a pretty critical piece of evidence just from listening to what went on, that was very critical.
Especially when your star witness, you said identified him and had the best view of anybody, saw him wearing glasses before the fight and not wearing them after.
And then to say that he just picked them up somewhere and these specific glasses, and her description of the glasses matched the glasses that they found?
They did, kind of, but they did also match the description that Gwen Owens gave, who also saw the glasses. So, I mean, it's theoretically possible that she picked up that part of her story from someone else, depending on what she actually saw that night.
Simple explanation. It's much simpler for glasses to fall off the head of someone during an altercation than it would be for someone to pick up a pair of glasses that somewhat fit a description and drop them out of his pocket during a fight that just happened to be I mean, that's much more improbable than the glasses falling off the assailant, you know? I mean, like, by how many levels of probability, right? I mean,
of course, there's one more theory about how the glasses could have gotten there and not have come on the killer's face. And that's if someone was trying to frame someone else.
Ah.
Which heard people suggest. I'm not saying that's the idea.
Dennis dropped them there.
Or someone did drop them there yet to frame someone else.
Yes, exactly, Rabia. I like how you think. he's a criminal mastermind. He cut the phone lines. Yes. Yeah, that is the sad part about the glasses is that because they were found on the floor, you know, it's difficult to, you know, absolutely tie them. And because Cora, it's the same thing for us who are trying to take a reading on Cora's use as a witness. You know, if we believe that she was able to see the killer in the vestibule with his glasses on, then perhaps she saw the rest of it, you know, but it's impossible to tell at this point.
Susan, were they able to determine, like, the power of the glasses?
Yeah. We have the lens power.
You do have, okay. So did anybody ever check, like, in the area or in the region or whatever? I mean, like, county maybe to see, like, with opticians, optometrists to see, like, who would have this exact, like,
it, they tried. We'll get more into that. They tried. It was not going to be a successful way of looking into it. It's kind of the thing where, like, it's, you can't really use the glasses to find the killer, but if you find the killer, you can use the glasses to confirm it, sort of deal.
Really? I mean, I would think that there would be a way to trace back, like, you know, the make of the lens, the make of the frame. I mean, like, people, you know, police do use things that they find, products, you know, things like that. You can, you know, pieces of paper, yeah, that find it.
I thought so too. I had the same exact thought process. And then eventually I'm like, okay, well, fine. I guess I can see why they gave up on that.
You'll have to explain to us later, because I still believe it.
And Dennis never worked at a place where there was any welding?
Welding? No, no. He was not a welder. He did, like, concrete work. He is not a welder.
We've got a bunch of social media questions, some of which we've already gotten into. But a lot of people were very dubious about the way that Detective Bundy worked. Still, to me, bringing in an outside investigator 13 years after the fact is always going to be a little shady to me. But at any rate,
he wasn't outside. Now, he had been, he was actually working at the sheriff's department the night the murders happened. He just started. He just become a law enforcement officer like a month or two before. And then he'd left the force, come back, and then left the force again, and then come back again. So he was not an outsider necessarily. He just was on an off-again spell in his off-again, on-again relationship with the sheriff's department.
Well, King Vitamin One begs to differ. He says Bundy's story of how all this went down doesn't pass the smell test. This whole, it's about time, sit down, and I'll tell you all you need to know bit. Sorry, not buying it. That's just a comment, not a question. But we also got from DIY Greg, who says, the more I hear about Dale Bundy, I wonder what other investigations he has railroaded people in order to solve cases. Have you looked into any other cases he's been involved in, like you did with the Baltimore cops in the Freddie Gray series?
I have. There's not really that many more cases in Camden County. He'd done, by 2003, he'd worked on a total of 3 murder cases only. So it's not like he had that many in his past. I know this is getting way off topic. There is a dispute about another case that he handled where he concluded it was a suicide, and some people disagreed with his decision and thought it was a murder. But I'd say that's a sort of different sort of dispute than what will be involved here.
Okay, we also got a question from Emily Waltz, who asks, how does the motorcycle come into play when the witnesses said a car was at the church?
I don't even know. Like, it gets him to Camden County. That's all that matters. There's no one saw a motorcycle involved in the murder. That's not part of it. No one saw that. So the motorcycle is purely to find a way to explain how on earth you could have gotten Dennis Perry from near Atlanta to Camden County.
We've got a comment out of left field here from Steve Langridge, who says, 3 of the pics, they're talking about the composite photos, could easily be a woman, ? In parentheses.
It's girly James Vanderbeek, or girly Kurt Cobain, I guess.
Kurt Cobain was kind of cool because he was kind of girly.
I was about to say, that already is, like, that's just Kurt Cobain.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of that. It could be that's just how the composites ended up looking, and that there was none of the women that I can recall, thinking back, I've never seen a comment from any of them who said he looked kind of girly. So I don't know if that was an intentional way of making him look. Now, I will say I've seen some people who are reported as possible matches for the composites that have, like, sort of a girly, I don't know, this is a horrible word to use, but have, like, a vaguely effeminate sort of appearance. And you see them and look at the photos, you're kind of like, oh, God, maybe, because for whatever reason, that sort of looks similar. And you can see why they were reported in the first place. But yeah, I have no idea if that's because the guy actually had an effeminate look, or if that's just how the women ended up making the composites look.
Yes, or the artist who made the composite. You know, you never know if that is just, you know, their style.
Yeah.
It's very hard to glean it from that. Okay. From Amanda Glazer, we have the question, how is it not considered hearsay when the police are making statements of what a suspect said without any kind of record?
Well, it's always hearsay because it's an out-of-court statement reported in court. So the question is it admissible hearsay? And in this case, yes, they were able to admit it.
And that's just always up to the judge to make that
judgment. Based on the rules and based on, like, well, we need Colin here to give us a full rundown on it. But admission against interest would be admissible in court.
We've got another question from Sierra Abernathy, who says, the witness that saw the shooter, and I'm assuming she's talking about Venzola Williams, did they ever say they saw glasses on the shooter?
You know, I almost put this in the episode. It was so frustrating. I ended up taking it out just for time reasons. So she initially does not say that. She initially does not report glasses. She also does say that she was looking more at the ground and looking at the guy's shoes more, because she was not trying to talk to this guy. She was just trying to scuttle out and go get her daughter. So she didn't look at his face directly, really. She was kind of looking at his feet a lot of the conversation. She did not say glasses then. We get to her first testimony at a hearing about a year and a half after Dennis is arrested. And she's asked about glasses, and she says, yeah, he had glasses on that looked like this. And then suddenly she changes her mind and says, oh no, he didn't have glasses. And the defense attorney is like, wait, you just said he had on glasses. And she says, I was talking about the glasses I was wearing.
Okay.
That's a trial. Yeah, like, I don't even know what to make with that. Like, that's all, like, she very clearly says, like, describes the glasses he is wearing. She's asked about the glasses he's wearing. And then suddenly says, no, he wasn't wearing glasses. I got confused. I was talking about my glasses that I was wearing.
Do you think somebody could have signaled to her that that's not the answer?
Ixnay on the answer way.
She didn't report glasses initially. So that's probably why I didn't include in the episode, because I don't even know what to make of it. It doesn't get us anywhere. Like, what does that even mean? Does it mean she could have seen them and then changed her mind? Or does it mean she just got confused and when asked about the glasses the guy in the vestibule is wearing, she answered about her own?
Maybe. We have one last question from Baroness Kate, who says, the glasses could have been used by the killer as a disguise for when he peeked through the door, ? The idea being that he would have tried to obscure his face somewhat when he peeked through the door, but then taken them off to commit the actual crime.
I mean, it would have been like blinding yourself, because if you've ever worn glasses that don't belong to you, like, it's going to distort your vision massively. It wouldn't be a great disguise, because they're like pilot's glasses, I guess I'd say, aviator style, maybe that's the right word. So they're big, wide glasses they're not that obscuring. And also, they obscure your vision out more than they ever obscure anyone's vision in of you.
I just wanted to bring up the fact that Cora Fisher's identification is one thing we've talked about in the past. It's a transracial identification. Something that we've talked about on the podcast, that when people are identifying people of another race, they often have a much harder time, or they're much less exact than they normally would be with somebody of their own race, or somebody who they are culturally around a lot more. And the fact that obviously, you know, Cora in her own particular situation had very strong reactions to, you know, seeing white people. Did the defense bring that up at all?
They did not. I'm not sure they're aware of, like, cross-racial identification issues. I mean, in general, it's just a terrible situation for identification. You have, other than Venzola Williams, who has a more, not a great view, but a pretty, I'd say, average view for a witness in the case, you have women who are making a cross-racial identification of a guy they saw for, like, a half-split second. He poked his head in, went back. So a split second, they didn't know at the time that happened. None of them knew anything was wrong. None of them knew that it was something significant. They weren't trying to recall what he looked like. So you got that half-second look under no reason to really pay attention. And then 15 years later, you're asked to identify the guy. It would be shocking to have a great outcome there in terms of identification accuracy.
Well, Stephen, do you have any more questions that you have for Susan?
Well, I guess I'm still trying to, like, kind of wrap my mind around, and I'm speaking, you know, purely from my experience in Baltimore and, you know, the problems with witness identification, which is really interesting because every time we release someone here now, you know, Marilyn Mosberry, state's attorney, has been talking a lot about that. And it seems to me there's this, some recognition at this point with law enforcement that, you know, witness ID is so difficult and so problematic. And it's just interesting for me to see the politics. I mean, I'm really going to be curious to see how this evolves, how the politics sort of push this case to trial, because, you know, the things you brought up are so alarming from any kind of case that I've ever covered. I mean, I've covered some pretty bad murder cases in terms of poorly. I mean, this is really significant. I mean, it just doesn't sound like something that a prosecutor would want to be prosecuting. Given, you know, so many of the problems. I mean, the whole thing with the glasses, saying first I saw them and then they were my glasses. I mean, that would be.
And she's the good witness. She's the best witness, like the most, like, credible and solid one. And she actually usually is pretty solid and credible. That's the one time you're like, what the heck is going on? Because other than that, she's pretty you know, I would say there's no real red flags there.
Do you feel like there's any pressure on her to be the star witness from, you know, police or the community or anything in terms of just trying to say to her, well, you're going to bring justice for these, because obviously these the people, the couple was beloved. And, you know, obviously, do you feel like she felt any pressure to kind of deliver for, you know, her friends or deliver for the community, or that the police were pressuring her or the prosecutors? Because it just it strikes me as so weird.
I am sure she felt pressure. I think the pressure would have been even independent of any external forces. This is someone she knew, a couple she knew. So I'm sure the pressure there to not ruin the case must have been huge, even ignoring all external factors. You can tell a lot that she changed her testimony and the way she phrased things between her hearing in August of 2001 and February of 2003, when she actually went on the stand again at trial. But even at trial, she does acknowledge that she is not sure of her identification. So she is not pressured enough where she's saying, like, oh, yeah, it's definitely him. What she does is kind of downplays her lack of certainty. But at the August hearing, a year and a half after the arrest, a year and a half before the murder trial, she is very clear. She's like, I said it looked like him, but I can't be sure.
Wow. And how old was she when she finally tested, when they finally took her deposition or whatever it was? How old was she at that point?
Oh, gosh. I know Cora was older. She might have been in her 70s by then. I think Fanzola Williams was probably in her 60s.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, not saying that, you know, it totally makes a difference, but there could be some cognitive issues. Who knows, you know? But
well, for Cora Fisher especially, I wonder. I mean, we know she's in a nursing home. We know that she lived for like many years after her deposition. So she was not on like death's door, but she also was in a nursing home. And some of her answers are kind of confused. And you have to wonder whether the same part, like, is it possible she was a little bit easier to influence because of it?
Well, you know, she's in a nursing home. And then, you know, police and prosecutors are showing up in the nursing home, and just the sense that she's given a sense of importance and relevance to this case could give her some impetus, or maybe create an atmosphere of pressure where she feels like she's got to deliver on some. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that would be what I would think in her situation. That would be obvious because of, you know, where she is in the phase of her life, just having all these people pay attention to her could be influential.
One question they've never asked or never tried to answer is, why only Fanzola and Cora? Why put the pressure all on them? There were many more surviving witnesses at the time. Why not give them a chance to make an identification and help out the testimony?
Probably because they couldn't, right?
Well, they were never asked.
They were never asked?
Never asked.
That's unusual. I mean, yeah. the defense didn't try to call them?
They did attempt to contact Cora and Fanzola. Cora did talk to them. She kind of said the same thing. She was not really... I mean, the same sort of answers, basically. Fanzola wouldn't talk to them. And the other woman they did try to talk to agreed to talk, but she was not one of the women that had seen his face.
Yeah.
I have to say, I would have considered her deposition very compelling as a jury member only because of who it's coming from. It's it's a woman who's in a nursing home. This happened a long time ago. This is I'm sure a horrible traumatic event in her life. These were two of her friends who were gunned down right in front of her. As a jury member, I would have had an incredible bias toward, if I heard that woman say, I know this is the guy. I know this is a guy he used to. There ain't no doubt. I saw him in front of my house. Yes, even if she added the caveats, all white people look the same to me, and I faint whenever I see a white person or a picture of a white person. I have to say, that would have been very, very compelling to me as a jury member, because it's all emotionalism. It is not intellectualism at that point. It's, you know, this woman who's near death is pointing a finger and saying that's the guy. It carries a lot of weight.
It does. Although I wonder what would happen if they decided to show her first composite, the one she did by herself, and ask her what she thought of that in comparison to Dennis Perry.
Yes, there's a lot of roads not taken in this case. Well, thank you, Stephen, so much for being here. I will check out The Land of the Unsolved, your podcast. How long have you been doing the show?
We've just been doing it for about 7 or 8 months. I mean, because we just decided there were a lot of cases we didn't have time to explore in our regular jobs as reporters. So we thought it would be a way to delve into them a little bit. So not that long, you know, but the cases we talk about are cases we've been reporting on for years. So it's been a work in progress, I guess. Now we're just using podcasts to explore more details.
That's what's great about podcasts. Well, thank you. I will check it out. And thank you, Robbie and Susan. Mm-hmm. And that's another addendum for you. There will be another one next week if you're filling out your calendar. If you feel like checking out our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, there is a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to right there. I am donating my fees for this season to the Georgia Innocence Project. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon. I want to thank Hannah McCarthy of Partners in Crime Media for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan. I always leave her for last, but she is certainly not least. Thank you, Methil. Have a great week, everybody.